Good morning. So once again, I'm Linda Scott. So I moved here about 3 years ago, and I had been in the United Kingdom. I was a professor at the University of Oxford, and I retired now, but I'm grateful to be continuing the work that I started over there, and that's what I'm going to share with you this morning. At Oxford, I was lucky to become part of a movement that calls itself Women's Economic Empowerment. And even though it still does not have a great deal of public awareness around the world, it is in fact a very important movement that involves a really remarkable coalition of the governments that give international aid, the global charities, the international agencies like UNICEF and the World Bank, and surprisingly, perhaps some of the largest corporations in the world. And what this movement grew out of initially was data that the world had not had before this time of big data that taught us something about the impact of gender inequality and caused us to be very concerned about it, very hopeful about what we could achieve, what humanity could achieve if it got rid of gender inequality. And a lot of my work is about trying to figure out how it works on the ground and what we can do to get rid of gender inequality. In the beginning, the information that I'm talking about was pulled together by international agencies who took certain indicators like adolescent fertility, primary education, maternal mortality, right to vote, things like that that are gender related, and created indexes that you could rank from top to bottom of high gender equality and low gender equality. And it was a remarkable discovery because what happened was is that you saw at the top nations who were stable, wealthy, had universal education, and health care available. And at the bottom, what you saw were very poor nations that were usually involved in conflict and were especially prone to being autocratic states. In between, you could see almost a stair step of progression. So it was fairly clear, even to the naked eye, that there was something going on there. Now, initially, what people said was, oh, the wealthy nations can't afford to set their women free. That's a luxury they can afford, whereas these nations at the bottom can't afford to do that. Well, over the last 10 years, we've discovered that actually the causality runs in exactly the opposite direction, that, and I can back this up, that the wealthy nations, because they set their women free, became wealthy. It was that made them rich. And that it's because the nations at the bottom don't allow their women any freedom that they continue to be stuck in this horrible cycle of conflict and poverty. This happens largely because if you take, for example, fertility as fertility is the number of children a woman has on average during her life, as an indicator of gender inequality, which it is, because it largely is a proxy for the lack of ability to have sovereignty over your own body. What you find is that the high fertility tracks along with conflict and autocratic states. And the reason that happens is that the high fertility with the conflict creates a population profile where you have too many young people at the bottom, and the high mortality among the older people causes it to squeeze, so there are very few at the top. And one of the problems that happens is that you end up with too many young men relative to the rest of the population, and they fight. And people say, you know, in the news they'll tell you there's a reason, and there is a reason, but honestly, demographically, if you've got that many young men in a population, if they don't have a reason to fight, they will find one. All right, I would say, so you get involved because of the excessive fertility, this constant cycle. And that, of course, puts a squeeze on resources, and people get angry about that, and food security gets bad, and people fight when they're hungry, and it just goes on and on. So it's a very difficult situation, and once it starts, it's almost impossible to stop it. The fertility can be addressed by what's called family planning, But unfortunately, a lot of what happens is coercive sex. It's polygamy, often of an informal variety, and what I often call just reckless sexual behavior. And so it's very difficult to fight with family planning. It's something that we've discovered, though, is that if we can economically empower the women, they very often have the strength to pull back, to stand up to abuse, to be able to pick up their children and go somewhere else if things are bad at home. And so that is a lot of why the movement focuses on their economic enablement. Now, today there is going to be a girl effect table afterwards, so I want to focus on the two strategies that have been adopted most often by this movement, and those are girls' education and women's entrepreneurship. Both of these are very strongly, very effective, more the girls' education, just because we're still experimenting with the entrepreneurship, but these are both areas that the Girl Effect Group is involved with, so I wanted to pick those today. In the situation of entrepreneurship, in these kinds of circumstances, the women are not able, usually not allowed, to go out to work, but they can do a little bit of a business of their own. Either, for example, selling produce or selling livestock or eggs, something like handicrafts. And so the idea is to help them to be able to develop businesses, to increase their number of customers, to have command over resources. And one of the main reasons that people are interested in doing this is that we have learned that when women have money and the freedom to spend it, which are two very different things, that they spend it first on their children. And I mean, you can just take that to the bank. They will spend it first on their children, and their priorities are good nutrition, education, and health care. Okay, so that there is not only in the immediate moment some reduction in things like domestic violence, but there is an investment going long into the future in what economists call human capital, right? And so this is something that there's a lot of focus on, and I've done a lot of work in this. The girls' education part is a complex, it has a complex set of effects, but it is a very rapid impact, so there has a lot of focus on it. And the way that works is not necessarily the way that a Western viewer would expect. It's not just that you educate these girls so that they can get jobs, because jobs are few, and there's just not that much of a link. We have found that when there are jobs, the girls get to stay in education longer because their parents see a long-term benefit from it. But more immediately, it's that if they stay in school, it closes the window a little bit on the number of years that they will be childbearing. Because what happens to them is that once they have reached puberty, they're seen as available, ready, marriageable. And so in their very early teens, they end up being traded. In cultures of this sort, usually marriage is more of an economic transaction, and it's the father with the potential husband. So it's really about transfer of wealth more than affection or long-term commitment. Or they get raped very often going to and from school, actually, or they run away to avoid all of that, and they end up in human trafficking or prostitution. So what happens as a result of this, then, as you can see, are many, many opportunities for excessive fertility to repeat itself. In addition, these kinds of circumstances spread disease, particularly sexually transmitted disease. And so by keeping girls in school, you're able to reduce the disease burden that happens as well. Girls who have been educated are better able to stand up to domestic violence, so you reduce that as well, which, by the way, is an extremely costly phenomenon in addition to being just wrong. Nations spend on average 5% of GDP on domestic violence. It's huge. They spend as much as they do on primary education. So reducing that is very important as well. In particular, also, when you have girls getting pregnant that early, it's extremely dangerous for them, and it's dangerous for their child. So high adolescent fertility also tracks along with high maternal mortality and high infant mortality, which are horrible for populations. They leave a lot of children orphaned, for example. So all of these things come from just keeping the girls in school and showing that they have value. So it is, if you can keep a girl from not having her first child till she's 18 or 19 instead of 13 or 14, it is a really, really rapid impact. And so it's definitely one of the things that we focus on most. In general, in fact, it's the low value, and particularly the low economic value that cultures in this particular situation put on female life. That leads them often to sell young girls into human trafficking. So this is a very important phenomenon as far as feeding that horrible trade, which in turn creates a lot of geopolitical instability. The organized crime networks that go with human trafficking are very dangerous for all of us. So you can see, I hope, that women's economic empowerment, women's empowerment generally, is a very, very important cause, and we're all hoping that we'll have more public awareness and commitment in the future. Now that we have this information and we understand more about how it works, we know actually that gender inequality has an enormous footprint. There's gender inequality in every country of the world, and it has an incredible amount of destructive capacity. For that reason, some experts are saying it's going to be the next big thing, is getting rid of gender inequality, and that it will eventually become as important as climate change as a cause, just because of how massive the impact of it is. So I hope that you all will be ready to commit to that. It is a very important cause, and you can start by stopping by the Girl Effect table on your way out. Thank you.